The Guardian.
Hello everyone, this is Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Today, the Carabao Cup. Just when you thought no one cared, Bristol City beat Manchester United. Magic. A frantic last minute at the Bridge as Chelsea edged past Bournemouth. City and Arsenal also through, but more importantly, as Barry bought his box. Paul Clement sacked for the third December in a row. Swansea City decide it's time for a new manager. Also, we'll look ahead to a big weekend of Premier League action and El Clasico with Sid, plus your questions, feedback corner, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Paul Doyle, nice to see you.
You too, Max.
You almost died right at the start. If you could stay with us here for the next hour and a half, you've bought a
What was in that coffee that the producer gave me?
You've bought in a small, I would say, A6, totally blank notepad.
Yeah, I'm. This is to take notes from what you guys say.
Oh,
I'm hoping
see.
You'll educate me today.
You're here to learn. It's a fully Irish panel today. Lars Sivertsen, how are you?
Eggs, Max. Eggs. That's what I had.
Oh, Ole Andreas M. Olsen says, what did Lars have for breakfast? How many eggs and how were they cooked?
Just fried, real quick. We've not done a big shop this week, so we kind of ran out of proper food, so I just had egg.
Oh, I see. You couldn't have, a lamb tagine. You had to have something weird.
It's funny you say that. I might have one later today.
Of course you might. And tomorrow morning. Barry.
Hello.
Do your work.
Oh, sorry, yes.
It's okay. There's the Carabao box, and let's talk about the Carabao Cup then. The semi-final lineup: Chelsea, Arsenal, Man City, Bristol City. Bristol City 2, Manchester United 1. This was great, wasn't it, Baz?
I really enjoyed that match, but not so much that I wanted it to go to extra time, because I was doing the minute-by-minute report, and nobody ever wants a minute-by-minute report to go to extra time. So I was... couldn't have been more pleased that Bristol City scored in the third minute of added time. I suspect also that the referee didn't want it to go to extra time, because I was sort of thinking it was Mike Dean, and I was kind of going, he should have blown the whistle by now. He's really letting this drag on. It actually entered my head, he doesn't want added time. He's giving somebody every opportunity to score a late winner. And Bristol City grabbed that opportunity with both hands.
Referees get paid a little bit extra if it goes to extra time?
I don't know. I know match reporters don't. And I know, like, TV match reports, because I asked Bianca Westwood once, if a match goes to extra time, do you get more money? And she said no. And she said, do you? And I don't know. So I doubt anyone does. Players might have it written into their contracts, but it wouldn't be in their best interests to do that. You know, you're not selling yourself very well if you insist on that clause being in your contract. But Jose Mourinho has got a lot of stick for being ungracious in defeat by saying Bristol City were lucky. For once, I'm inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt. I thought maybe they were a little bit lucky, because Manchester United were turning the screw and battering them towards the end. But they also thoroughly deserved their win. And I think it's a little bit unfair to criticise Jose for saying they were lucky, because A, they were a bit, and B, I just think he's gone past the point where he's just incapable of any form of graciousness, and that's about as gracious as he can get, by saying, you know, it was a good night for football and that they did very well. And also, he made a critical point, I think, which a lot of people seem to have overlooked. Maybe they didn't hear the interview, or he didn't say it in his press conference afterwards. But he said a lot of his players quite clearly didn't fancy it. It was another day at the office for United, and a lot of his players didn't want to be in the office. And you know, the manner in which Bristol City were sort of dominated midfield for large parts of the game, were quicker to every ball, would suggest he was right.
Well, I think that was a case of sort of Clattenbergian refereeing. Like, he just managed the spectacle. He just thought, never mind the rules and when I should blow up. You know, it would be so much fun.
I just wanted to go home.
It would be great if someone scored here. It would be a good spectacle, you know.
How much time? Was it only 3 minutes? The Man City-Leicester match was 8 minutes at the end of full time on Tuesday.
Speaking
which is a precedent that that I'm glad to see set.
What, there were that many minutes in there?
There should be much more.
I agree. I think when teams score now, they're really hugging for a long, long time because they're thinking, look, let's pretend we're really happy. We are happy, but at the same time, this is minutes we're eating up.
Yeah, well, they have a whole choreographed dance routine to go through, some of them. And every time the ball goes out of play, the clock should stop, in my opinion.
Really?
But I wonder about the psychology of this game from Man United's perspective, because Bristol City, they're third in the Championship, they've only lost three games all season, they've already knocked out Watford, Stoke and Palace, so famously they've beaten more Premier League teams than both Swansea and West Brom have done all season, so if you take this sort of thing lightly, you're going to be knocked out, and you wonder if they'd played Swansea in the league, if their approach mentally would have been different, and if so, why?
Well, producer Jonathan made a point saying, you know, everyone's getting misty-eyed about Bristol City beating Manchester United, but they could play them twice next season. I mean, he is a Bristol Rovers fan. I don't know if that's got anything to do with it whatsoever.
I didn't see the match, but I saw their two goals, which were both very nicely created and taken goals. But also, it's quite damning. It's quite a blow to United, isn't it, to be knocked out? They are the holders of the tournament. They're not going to win the Premier League this year. So this is a good trophy for them to win. Mourinho clearly wanted to win it. So, I mean, he was motivated and appears to have failed to have motivated some of his players. I know he threw Lukaku on towards the end, which is a further indication of his desire to win it. So he'll be very annoyed within the dressing room, I imagine, with certain players who probably won't be getting many more chances.
Lee Johnson done very well, and he says it was such a brilliant night. And he just says, look, it's nights like this we dream of. It's Roy of the Rovers stuff. To beat Manchester United at home is incredible. I'm proud of everyone. I'm chuffed to bits. The celebration when he picked up that ball boy and he said, I didn't know what to do. Laugh, cry, cuddle each other. No one knew. I was going to run on the pitch. Then I realised I couldn't. So it was great to see him, the ball boy. I needed to celebrate with someone. And I found this. Joe Sims, who's an actor who was in Broadchurch.
Happy Christmas. Happy Christmas. Come here.
Sounding more like anyone from Bristol than anyone has sounded before. Just brilliant for them, Barry.
Yeah. My only concern for them is that it's a cup run that's possibly come at the wrong time for them, because I haven't seen them play much this season, but if they play like that all the time, they're genuine promotion contenders. They only made one change from the team that beat Forest last weekend. I think that's their fourth or fifth win in a row now. They changed their goalkeeper. Luke Steele plays most of their Carabao Cup matches, but otherwise it was the same 10 outfield players that started against Forest. They've now got City. One suspects this may be where their run comes to an end. It's probably the worst draw they could have got in terms of beatable opposition. You know, you'd give them a very good chance against Arsenal, you'd give them a decent chance against Chelsea, City, that's a toughie. But I think, you know, with promotion so tantalisingly close for them, maybe this is a distraction they could do without. Yet, you know, and for Bristol City to be in a position where we're saying being in the semi-final of one of the big cup competitions is possibly a distraction they could do without, shows how far they've come. They have a huge injury list. Like, they have an awful lot of players out long term. I think they had 10 or 11 players unavailable through injury or ineligibility last night. So, you know, their squad is quite threadbare.
He seems like a really interesting guy, Lee Johnson. You read interviews with him. He's a sort of old school in the sense that he values the blood and thunder and hard work, but he's also very interested in like technology. And he talks about wanting a massive screen on the training ground like they have at Hoffenheim, and like he's made an app for his players, you know. And he's well into this sort of thing.
He does, because I interviewed him on the radio, and he was talking about his app. And the day before a game, you know, he sends all the players what they need to do, and then he then has to spend the next day checking if they've checked the app, obviously, which might not happen.
But this is interesting, because I think in our haste to sort of reject and ridicule the old school proper football men, I think it's important to remember that there's a lot of those values that are integral to playing football, and you can combine that sort of outlook on life with a slightly more progressive approach in other areas. And it seems to me like he's got a good record, or he's struggled last season, but he's got them playing really well now. He's done well at smaller clubs in the past, and you wonder if he's the sort of guy who you'd like to see be given a chance in the Premier League, either with Bristol City, obviously, or with someone else. I mean, when we talk about English managers not getting a chance, it's a bit misguided because there are some English managers who get a lot of chances, and then everyone who's out of that sort of merry-go-round don't get. So maybe, you know, a guy like him, you'd like to see get an edge.
Yeah. Swansea's not too far away, is it? Daniel says, I've heard of players trying to get sent off to get Christmas off, but was Romero trying to get sacked last night? I actually thought... it was quite an interesting tactic by the Bristol City players every time Romero got the ball to just run into him, basically, so he couldn't distribute the ball, which is sort of what people need to do to Edison and other goalkeepers who are quite good at passing it.
Yeah, I didn't think Edison, or sorry, I didn't think Sergio Romero was particularly bad.
No, neither
bad
did I,
last night. He did okay.
It's just a funny tweet.
Oh, yeah.
It used to be part and parcel of a goalkeeper's skill set was the ability to hold on to the ball and barge people out of the way. I mean, back in Lee Roos, one of my favourite players of all time, is single-handedly almost responsible for a change in the rules because goalkeepers used to be able to handle the ball anywhere within their own half. Now, very, very few did.
How long ago is this?
This was at the start of the 20th century. Huh. And very few did. But he would always go running out of the box, like a rugby player, running up the players, shoving players out of the way. He famously, it was on a tour match in Ireland, actually, when he was playing for Stoke, I think, he knocked one of the wingers off the pitch and into a hospital. He was unconscious. And he wouldn't release until he got to the halfway line. And so because of him, they changed it. The goalkeepers weren't allowed to carry the ball outside their box.
I love these anecdotes you bring, Paul. What was his name again?
Lee Roos. There's a million brilliant anecdotes about Lee Roos. Uh-huh. He's one of the great characters of English football, or Welsh football. He was Welsh.
So Bristol City are going to play Manchester City, who beat Leicester 4-3 on penalties. Two second-string sides. Look, Claude Puel can understand... You're not going to keep your job necessarily if you get to the League Cup final because he's got to the League Cup final and he didn't keep his job. But of all the teams that have played second string sides, it seems very strange that he didn't give this a go. Leicester aren't going to go down.
Yeah, no, this is complete nonsense. I completely understand if you're fighting to win the league or you have a good chance at a top four spot or you're fighting relegation, fine. You know, throw the cups out the window. It's sad, but I completely understand why clubs do that. But for Leicester, like, you're not going to go down. And look, I have bad news for you, Leicester. You're probably not going to make the Champions League either. So there's no reason at all to not just go completely all in for the cups. I mean, I can't...
Especially as it gets them into Europe.
Yes, I can see any possible reason for them to not make that a big priority.
Can you, Barry?
Yeah, I agree.
The sort of diving, not diving story came out again in this game. Damari Gray got a penalty where he might have jumped his legs into the defender. Kyle Walker was booked where it could have been a penalty. I'm not sure what my question is. Will this ever stop? But there's a lot of players kicking into other players, flailing their legs out.
It won't stop. It'll spread. And Kyle Walker himself gave a demonstration of that because literally the 1 minute after having that penalty awarded against him, he went up and tried it on the other end and got booked.
But I couldn't tell it. I thought his was more, the one he got booked for was more a penalty than the one that Gray got a penalty for.
But again, what's your question?
I think the rules need to be clarified when it comes to simulation.
Well, applied. The rules are clear. They just need to be applied.
Okay. So certainly so. Because the rules say, well, we've done this on the pod before, I think. There's a paragraph in the laws of the game where, you know, an action that makes it look like something has happened when it hasn't is simulation. And if you apply that rigorously, then all this stuff about whether there's contact or not shouldn't come into it at all. Like if you hurl yourself at a defender and fall down, that is diving as much as whether you hurl yourself, miss the defender and fall down. You know, but you're completely right. It's not applied at all. And there's an obsession in TV studio, certainly when analysing this, is like, was there contact? It's not to do with it. It's got nothing to do with it at all. And I wonder, I'd really like, this is where it would be good if referees came out and spoke more. Like, what are the criteria they actually look for in situations like that? Because I honestly have no idea.
I don't think referees should have to come out and speak because they're at a disadvantage. It's just like putting them in stocks.
That's how they should do it, though, shouldn't
they? All they can say is, well, that's how I saw it. And we've all been at matches and thought we saw something, and then when we've seen it later on TV, you go, "Ooh, I got that wrong." They're not given enough assistance, so it can't make them into sacrificial lambs.
I should clarify. I didn't say I don't think they should come into the mix zone after every game and be pilloried for mistakes they've made. But it would be interesting to have them at least explain in a very clear manner, like, what is a penalty, what is diving, contact in the box, like what are the criteria we're actually judging this from? Because the rules say one thing, and it doesn't seem to be applied in that way at all, and that confuses me.
But I think that would be of benefit to reasonably minded, smart people. And, you know, we've all read the comment section, the one under the top 100 players of the year is always a beauty. I was perusing that yesterday, and there are people complaining about the list. The list hasn't even been published yet. You know, there's still 41 players to go, and they go, "Why isn't? Oh, where is? How dare you?" People getting very, very angry about, you know, someone, a jury of 169 people arriving at a different conclusion to the one they would arrive at. But so, yeah, if referees came out and explained themselves, it would benefit some people, but most people have their minds made up and are so one-eyed and blinkered, they won't change their view no matter what they're told.
Something we can all agree on, Jimmy Solano says, picking up on something, "I really like Claude Puel's gilet puffer waistcoat. A beautiful thing to behold, hashtag fashion icon. Is a wonderful thing. It's quite thin, so you can wear a suit jacket over it. Keeps Claude warm."
Good for Claude.
For Claude. I really like it. Slightly more serious news. A convicted football hooligan's been jailed for a racist and unprovoked attack on Raheem Sterling. That happened before the Spurs game. Carl Anderson, 29, pleaded guilty to racially aggravated common assault after Sterling was attacked outside the training ground.
I'm sure if that man had something, he had a problem with the decision made by Mike Dean, and Mike Dean came out and explained himself. He goes, "Oh, thank you, Mike. I'm very glad you explained that to me. I see it now from your point of view. I do apologise for introducing your good name from the stands. You wanker."
Chelsea 2, Bournemouth 1. A really fun last minute where Dan Gosling equalised with a lovely strike for Bournemouth, and then Morata scored a lovely goal. Literally, it was classic Sunday League. You equalise and then one of your centre-backs shouts, "Nothing silly, next five, it's still nil-nil." And then they just conceded a goal. So Chelsea are through. They'll play Arsenal, who beat West Ham. Danny Welbeck with the only goal. Arsenal are in four cup competitions, have 10 games in 36 days. Olivier Giroud could be out for 3 weeks with a pulled hamstring. Theo Walcott was captain in only his third game in almost 2 months after illness and injury.
Mm-hmm. And after the last time he was captain, which I think I'm right in saying was at Crystal Palace last season, when Wenger, people were surprised at the nomination of Walcott as captain, and Wenger said, "Well, he embodies this club better than anyone." And they went there and they lost 3-0. And in his post-match interview, Walcott said, "Yeah, they were just more up for us than us." And I thought,
yeah. He does embody.
He does embody.
Exactly. He does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Thomas Rosicky retired yesterday. Another man who's been sort of injured a lot. Really great footballer, I thought. And sort of sad that he didn't have a wonderful career at Arsenal and it didn't go on to wonderful things.
Yeah, he's sort of a precursor to Jack Wilshere, if that's not damning him with faint praise. You know, good at driving forward, picking out a pass, ridiculously injury prone. You know, Manuel Adebayor once joked that if you said good morning to him at the training centre, he'd be out for 2.5 months. And that's unfortunate. Interesting Thomas Rosicky fact.
Oh, I think I know it. I hope it's the one I think it is.
His father, Yuri, was a professional footballer. Could never move club because he was in the Czech Republic under the communist regime. He could have gone on his own, but he didn't because he wasn't sure if his family would be able to follow him wherever he went. And then his mum was an international table tennis player, or top Czech table tennis player. Is that the fact you knew?
No, absolutely not. Mine was he's the last one from that Nike advert, which I think was in 2002 when it was player v player and it had like a big board on it. And I, can't remember any of the other footballers who were in it. But do you remember it, Lars?
Yeah. Davids was in there. He must have been there.
I think so.
I think Nakata was in there. There's a lot of that was a great campaign. Most of those are a bit annoying, but that one was amazing.
He was the last. He's the last one to retire. It's another sign that we're all aging. This advert, the cage, the Nike cage.
Was that the one, Eric Cantona was the ref?
Mm-hmm. It was on a boat.
The secret tournament. It was Henri Totti, Vieira, Van Nistelrooy, Scholes, Lundberg, Saviola, Luis Enrique, Davids, Thuram, Wiltord, Figo, Roberto Carlos, Ronaldo, Danielson, Ronaldinho, some others that I can't see because that bit of the photo is blurred. Anyway, they've all retired. So
it's time for a remake of that, isn't it?
Yeah. Who would you put in it?
All of them.
What, all of them?
all the ones you can think of. Come on.
What, Glenn Murray?
Yes.
He'd be first on my team sheet. Well, look, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll look ahead to the Premier League. We'll begin in Swansea, who've sacked Paul Clement. Welcome back to part two of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Before we talk about Swansea City, we're giving away our last 55-inch Toshiba telly. Paul, you haven't won it, unfortunately, but you wish you had.
I'm not telling this story on air.
Oh, you're not?
I bought myself a 55-inch TV recently in the pre-Christmas sales, and it lasted 3 days before it was smashed in a domestic incident.
Okay. That actually,
plastic hammer.
The way you've left the mystery makes it sound like you're quite a violent, aggressive man. You weren't in control. But you don't.
No,
have to
it wasn't me. It wasn't me.
No, it wasn't.
Nor any of the adults in the house.
Okay, good. But who has won the telly, Barry? You have to do a stick man drawing.
Yeah, of the podcast. Mm. It was a tough decision, a very tough decision, I have to say. But the winner for his interpretation, it's colour. It has Max crawling Bruce Willis in Die Hard style through a vent to return and save the podcast. I'm sitting on an iron throne made of betting shop pens. Philippe looking magnificent in a tricolour Santa hat doing an Icelandic thunderclap. And Jonathan Wilson sitting on an inverted pyramid. And there's also a cameo from AC Jimbo, who's sabotaging Sid's phone line. The Grinch taking revenge for the FSF award defeat by sabotaging Sid. And the winner is Adam Bates. So enjoy your new TV, Adam.
Yeah, and thanks, Toshiba. You're all great. I didn't get a free telly just for saying that. I just point that out.
But Paul would really like one.
Yeah, if you're listening, Toshiba people, Mr. Jeff Toshiba, could you send a telly to Paul Doyle at The Guardian?
Oh, as it's Christmas, by the way. Hello, Gillette. I asked for razor blades, Mac 3s, still haven't arrived. Get on it, please. They're far too expensive.
I'm thinking if it had been a Toshiba, it wouldn't have smashed Paul's TV because they're much more rugged and solid machines.
It's a very good
whereas
point
the
you
one
make.
Paul had couldn't withstand the impact of a plastic hammer.
Yeah.
Paul Clement's been sacked by Swansea. The chairman, Hugh Jenkins, said, "To change the manager, especially only the halfway point of the season, is the last thing we wanted to do. We all wanted to give Paul as much time as possible. But we couldn't leave it any longer. What he achieved in the second half of last season to keep us in the top flight was tremendous. We're all surprised and disappointed it hasn't worked out this season." You're laughing, Lars.
Why are they surprised?
I mean, if sacking a manager midway through the season is the last thing they want, I mean, they seem to do it an awful lot.
Yeah, well, they do it every year, actually.
Yeah, there's three managers in about 14 months now for Swansea, isn't it? And it's gone spectacularly wrong. And it seems a very long time ago when they were thought of as this sort of model club that's run exceptionally well. And because they were at the time, but it's all gone completely wrong. And the weird thing is that on paper, at least, it seems to be largely the same people doing it behind the scenes. So it's baffling that it's gone just completely, it's gotten so disjointed. Because there used to be this thing with Swansea is that they had a coherent plan. They hired managers where there was a logical sort of continuance from one manager to the next. They signed players who fit into the system they had. Now they don't seem to have a system, and they've hired managers who have nothing in common. And looking at what is being reported as the possible replacements, they don't seem to have a lot in common either. So there's a complete lack of joined up thinking at the club.
Mm-hmm. And that goes to player recruitment as well. Whichever manager does come in, we'll have probably the worst squad of players in the Premier League. So he's going to have to be one of the best managers in the Premier League.
Stuart James is our Swansea guy. We couldn't get him on today because logistical problems. But I was looking at an interview he did with Hugh Jenkins, November 2013. So that's 4 years ago. Attractive to watch on the pitch and well run off it, Swansea's model is widely viewed as the blueprint for clubs across all levels to follow. Today, Stuart James writes, what a mess Swansea City have become. There are problems on the field, off the field, and just about everywhere you look, so much so that it seems like a trick of the imagination that only a few years ago they were hailed as the Premier League's model club. Who on earth would want to follow their example now? I mean, the sacking of Clement is... yeah, it's not going to be a solution. History has proved that. When does Hugh Jenkins start to take responsibility? He's the guy who's appointing all these managers that don't work out. He seems to be in charge of player recruitment. So, you know, during the summer, they sold Gylfi Sigurdsson, sold Fernando Llorente, brought in Wilfred Bony, who isn't very good anymore and is injury prone and is now injured for Christmas. Tammy Abraham, who hasn't really impressed this season, will have to lead the Swansea line on his own over the festive period. They had the lowest net spend, I think, during the summer. And this is a club as well who were once brought in players like Michu, Michel Vermaan and Ashley Williams for next to nothing. And in the last 2 years, they spent $32 million on Frank Tabanu, Eder, Borja Baston and Alberto Palacci. 13 starts.
Could not pick them out of a crowd.
Honest to God, 13 starts between them.
Jordan Smith says, can Pulis reinvigorate Renato Sanchez's career by completely bypassing him every week? Or do you think Pulis would rather bypass Joe Allen in a Wales shirt every few months?
Well, Pulis didn't reinvigorate Gregor Krikoviak's career at West Brom, that's for sure. And Renato Sanchez is probably a harder puzzle to solve because he looks like a broken man this season. He's been so far away from the player who was one of the brightest prospects in Europe. The other tragedy of Swansea's situation is not just in terms of the player and the management, but the whole model of ownership, because they were saved by their fans and brought up. Their rise was while they were a fan-owned club, and then they sold out to these American bankers whose impact so far has been almost entirely negative.
It's interesting. Club captain Angel Rangel said recently in an interview that he was lamenting the sort of the passing of the Swansea way, just the fact that they're not playing the way they did when they came up, which is quite a big thing for a club captain to come out and say in the middle of a season. And I think it's often presented as an aesthetic choice, this idea of playing a possession-based game and being attack-minded and all of this. That is something you do to entertain the crowd from that. But it can also be... It's not just about aesthetics. It's about if you have a certain way of playing at the club that everyone knows, that can be a strength in terms of getting results as well, because you can sign players to fit that system and you can appoint managers who do this thing. So you have a coherent thing and it means it can give you an edge. So it's not that they were just passing the ball around because it looks nice. It's because it enabled them to become more of their than the sum of their parts. And right now they're just a hodgepodge of parts that don't fit together in any way.
That's why Huddersfield will survive this season. For example, everyone knows what they're doing. They've recruited accordingly and they've got tremendous spirit behind it. And that will keep them afloat.
You mentioned the rumoured people to take over. Louis van Gaal, Roberto Martinez, Ronald Koeman, Chris Wilder, all in the running.
There's no way Roberto Martinez, who has a chance of winning the World Cup next year, is going to go back to Swansea now.
Leon Britton's taking charge for their game against Palace, which in a way is sort of, that could be seen as sort of going away. Gary Monk sort of had that route, whether you'd... You know,
this is the thing, like trying to go back to that when you don't necessarily have the squad for it anymore and you're in the middle of a season where you look like you're heading for a relegation is probably not a great idea either. So,
well, they don't have the squad to do anything at the moment. That's why their most important decisions over the January, more than the manager, will be the players that they recruit. And obviously, get a manager first so he can choose the players he wants.
If you were Leon Britton, would you start yourself up front? Just because you could.
No.
Okay.
Well, if anything happens to Tammy Abraham, then maybe. I don't think there's anyone else.
It's a massive game. Palace as well. You know, they Palace are sort of stretching away, aren't they?
Palace are battered them, I'd say.
Yeah.
They're Swansea are an absolute mess.
Oh, I thought Swansea looked all right against Everton.
Palace, though, earlier in the season, didn't they? At Sellers Park. Or did they? Or is that a false memory? But I think Palace, they did.
The Palace are undefeated in seven now, so the Hodgsonisation is well underway, and it's sort of, you know, it's working.
They're fully Hodgsonised.
Yeah, and there is a thing to be said for, like, managers who, contradicting myself earlier, but experienced managers who know to just at least make you hard to beat. Like, if you're in a situation that Crystal Palace were in, and you're now in the situation that Swansea is in, if you can get someone in who will stop the rot as such and organise the team in a way that means you don't get smacked around every week, there's a thing to be said for that in certain circumstances, and certainly Hodgson has done that really well at Palace, and I wonder if Swansea might, you know, just until the end of the season, do whatever they can to stay up and then just regroup and come up with another plan in the summer.
That was a good job to get for Hodgson at Palace, because like Moyes at West Ham, they had good players there who any competent manager could turn around. It's not like Swansea where you're going to have to do something exceptional to turn them around. And so Hodgson, I was at the Leicester match last weekend where Palace won 3-0, which was with a very good performance, particularly from Zaha. And but afterwards, Hodgson was talking about, well, of course I've turned around. This is what I've been doing since 1976. And saying that all the negativity he's had in recent has been down to one match against Iceland. Other than that, he's been a managerial genius, which isn't the case.
I'm sure Liverpool fans who are listening are completely on board with that analysis of Roy Hodgson's career.
Let's look ahead to the other Premier League games. Then Arsenal-Liverpool on Friday night. It's starting to look like a key game, this, Barry, because Arsenal, Liverpool and Spurs are perhaps competing for fourth place now. Or is that too big a statement? You know, they could catch Chelsea, but Chelsea looking good and strong, and Man United, okay, they lost to Bristol City, but keep winning.
It's a key game for Arsenal and Liverpool fans, I suppose.
It's not for you.
It's hard to get excited about it. You know, I don't care who comes fourth. You know, it's not a team I support isn't going to come fourth.
You have a long season ahead then.
Well, I know.
The title is pretty much wrapped up and relegation
the relegation battle interesting, you know, championship, top of the championship I find interesting. But yeah, this assault on fourth.
But irrespective of what it means in the grand scheme of things, it's an exciting match in and of itself. I mean, it should be an absolute belter. I mean, it should be lots of goals. Two weak defences, two very good attacks going at it. It could be a lot of fun.
So Liverpool have scored 3 goals or more in their last 4 games against Arsenal, but Arsenal have won 13 of their last 14 at home. So, you know...
Liverpool have scored prolifically away, and I don't know the stats, but they've probably averaged 3 in their last 5 or 6 away games. And they're brilliant going forward. And I don't know if Oxlade-Chamberlain will start, probably not. But if he does, it'll be interesting to see to what extent he's been reinvented under Klopp. I think Klopp has been suggesting in the build-up that Wenger didn't get the best out of him, which is a statement of the obvious, I would say. But he's got a lot to prove, because Klopp's big money signings have pretty much all been successful so far, but Oxlade-Chamberlain is the most dubious one.
So do you think he's sort of been priming him on the training ground? There's just going to pull this dust cloth off and unleash.
Well, he's been good in his recent matches. In fairness, he was very good against Bournemouth last
year. Liverpool's the kind of team that Arsenal are not very comfortable facing, I think, in the sense that they've got so much pace and they're so aggressive, and they just love exploiting teams that allow them space to play in. And Arsenal, they tend to give them that. But having said that, you would have said the same before Tottenham played Arsenal, and that game became the complete opposite of what we were expecting. And Arsenal just found a sort of level of intensity we've not seen from them in a while. And they could do a similar thing with Liverpool, I guess, because I still, it's such a lazy observation, but I still think Liverpool are a bit suspicious at the back, you know.
Well, so. Of course they are, yeah. But they'll... The first half an hour will be really interesting, because Liverpool will go to try and blast them away, which even Jose Mourinho did, where normally parks the bus on his way matches, but he just got stuck into Arsenal from the start, and they were 2 up within whatever it was, 15 minutes. And Liverpool have done that in previous matches against Arsenal.
Are you excited yet, Barry?
No, I'm excited insofar as it should be a good game, but I'm just not excited about the race for fourth.
I think it probably is the battle for fourth, unless I think the Champions League is going to be key, because if either Chelsea or Man United go out in the next round or even in the quarterfinals, it could all unravel at those clubs, and they could there could be an amusing implosion, and they could tumble down.
Yeah, that would be. I'd quite, you know. Would we like a Jose implosion? Is that what we?
From a neutral's point of view, yes.
just on that subject of scoring goals, Arsenal have got 5 clean sheets in the last 7. Liverpool have got 4 clean sheets in the last 7. So it could be 0-0. Everton play Chelsea. Everton now 9th. Following that win against Swansea, well, they did play okay, but actually, I thought Swansea were better than them in the first half. This is Monday night. That's quite a long time. You're looking confused, Barry. It's quite a long time ago, Monday.
I didn't see this game, I'm afraid.
It was kind of Allardyce's time at Everton so far in the microcosm, because Everton weren't that good, but they were good in the decisive moments of the game. Like, they were able to keep the ball out of their net, and they were able to stick it in the opponent's net, which is quite important in football.
Sigurdsson scored a lovely goal, but the first, it was absolutely silent at Goodison. I mean, the atmosphere was sort of non-existent for the first half an hour, 40 minutes. I suppose the football they were being served up was not particularly exciting.
Well, I was looking at, for reasons I won't bore you with, but I was looking at an Everton fan chat forum yesterday, and it's quite, I thought they'd all be really pleased that Big Sam's dragged them away from the relegation zone, and they seem to have zoomed up the table at a rate of knots. But I suppose they haven't really played anyone good apart from Liverpool, and they were very lucky to get a draw in that game. I think, you know, they got away with it there. And I know a fan forum probably isn't the best barometer of public opinion, but a lot of them seemed very, very underwhelmed by Allardyce's appointment, whereas I thought they'd just have been happy that someone was steering them out of danger. But they all seem hugely concerned that he'll stay beyond next summer and get a long-term deal.
It's because it's kind of like appointing him is putting a limit on your ambitions, and those ambitions were so big in the summer. And it's one of the reasons why I think most Stoke fans don't want Tony Pulis back if Mark Hughes gets sacked. It's because they thought they'd moved on to something higher than what they can offer. You know,
he's the dream limiter.
It's like you've been given a motorbike, but here's some stabilizers.
I do agree with you. I'm not convinced that Sam's way can ever take you, you know, towards the top end of the table where Everton want to be. But it is also true that throughout his career, he's never really been at a club where he's had the budget and had the ability to actually realistically challenge any further up. So I certainly, and given how decent and good a job he's done at various smaller and less ambitious clubs, I think in a way it's kind of nice that he's gotten a shot at a club where he feasibly has the budget to actually punch upwards a little bit.
I think he could get good results. It's more with the aesthetic.
It's so hard to, if you're someone who's not in the top six, or even like, it's so hard to challenge them in any way because of the financial discrepancies. If Sam can do that, even if it doesn't look pretty at all times, I mean, if I was an Everton fan, I'd take that, to be honest.
Who do you think out of Roy, Moyes and Sam is the most sort of self-satisfied at home, sitting on their sofa in their underpants, watching Judge Judy, just going, yeah, I'm doing really well here?
Well, I can't imagine Roy or Moisey sitting at home, say, wearing a silk kimono, drinking an exotic cocktail with straws and umbrellas sticking out of it. Whereas I can imagine Big Sam doing exactly that. In fact, I'm imagining it now, and I wish you hadn't brought up the subject.
Well, fair play to him, you know. He's earned it even more than the others, I would say. They've all had good careers, but he's had the most credible.
And also, like, before we move on, Wayne Rooney, the 10 goals in 15 now. I mean, I don't think he's actually played that well at all times, and there's been a couple of penalties in there, but that's a lot better than I thought he'd do in the first half of the season. So, you know, fair enough.
Well done, Wayne.
Sorry, Paul, would you argue that Big Sam has had more credible career than Roy Hodgson? International man of mystery. You know, he's managed abroad. He's managed an Sam international team for managed, a little bit longer than...
he hasn't had failures on the scale that Hodgson has had.
Okay.
Even the England one, he was rather harshly dealt with.
Unbeaten.
There. Yeah, unbeaten.
100% record. Barry, how excited are you by the race for sixth place, Burnley v Spurs?
Well, this I'm beside myself about.
James Tarkowski has just been banned for 3 games, by the way, which makes a quite a big difference to Burnley's.
That's good. Because I wrote a preemptive things to look out for this weekend, in which I assumed Tarkowski would get a 3-match ban. It's an interesting one, actually, because Burnley were doing well, then they lost some key players and continued to do well. And Tarkowski's perhaps the most key player of them all, because he's played every minute for Burnley. He's been excellent in the centre of their defence with Ben Mee. Ben Mee was out for a bit. Kevin Long came in. He did all right. And so now, presumably, Kevin Long and Ben Mee. So this is another test for Burnley over 3 games. How will they get on without Tarkowski? If they can get through these 3 games without, doing too badly, I think definitely they are the real deal.
Lars, you hate Burnley?
I really don't. And I understand my views have been completely misrepresented on this pod in the past.
Whenever you're not here. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But no, I think they can get something out of this, because I think they're the kind of team Spurs really hate playing against, because Spurs are absolutely at their best when they have space to attack and when they have teams who come out and play them.
Like City.
I don't think anyone enjoys playing City.
No, that's true.
But when teams sit back and deny them space and Spurs have to sort of finesse their way through, they're not as good at that. And we've seen that a number of times. So I'm expecting them to struggle. And I think Burnley can get something from this.
Brighton play Watford, City play Bournemouth, Southampton, Huddersfield, Stoke, West Brom and West Ham, Newcastle. Do any of those games excite you?
I think Southampton Huddersfield is quite interesting.
I was about to say, I think that's because? Really interesting.
Well, Southampton really need a win. They're going through a wobble, you know, and I think their supporters are probably getting a bit jittery. They haven't won too many games of late. I don't have the exact figures to hand.
They haven't even scored many goals.
And resurgent Huddersfield put their inability to score away from home very much behind them last weekend. And I'd say if Southampton lose this game, yeah, worrying times. They're on the slide, you know, and teams below them are improving and on the up. So they could find themselves in trouble very quickly.
Leicester played Manchester United as well. I left that off your list, Paul.
Right. I was going to mention Brighton-Watford just because I'm intrigued by Watford. They're such a strange team.
They are.
And Marco Silva is a very strange manager. You can see all the positives he brings to them, but he does have some extraordinary bad spells as well. I mean, after even last season, after getting Hull out of the relegation zone, they had the most pathetic end of season to any team ever. They were getting tonked at home. Was a 4-0 by Sunderland and losing 7-0. It was an absolute spectacular flop. And Watford, despite playing well and looking almost like the sixth best team in the league, has had some shocking results. So this Brighton, who haven't scored in ages, probably go on a spree this weekend.
Well, Watford, you know, have to try and finish with 11 players, don't they?
Well, also, interestingly, it was in the corresponding fixture that Miguel Britos got sent off for that horror lunge on Anthony Knockhart. Now, if the two of them were going to be facing each other again, you could possibly see, this could be interesting, because I would imagine Brighton's players might want to exact a modicum of revenge on Mr. Britos, but he has been out with a foot injury. He's about ready to be picked or to be available for selection again. And I would think maybe even if he is fit, he might be one to leave out.
Do you think he could get higher if he on a challenge?
Well, I just think it's the kind of game where Brighton's players will remember that tackle. Now, Knockhart, just by a miracle, wasn't hurt. But they'll remember that. There might be revenge on their minds, and it could get very tasty indeed, which suggests both teams could struggle to keep 11 men on the field. But, as I said, Miguel Britos probably won't play, so it may not be an issue.
They've been pretty solid at home, Brighton. They've not been the most spectacular team in Huddersfield, of course, of the newly promoted ones. Perhaps been more interesting, but they've only lost 2 at home this season, and that was against Liverpool and City. So they're not easy to beat at the Amex, and I think it could be a really interesting game, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we'll round up.
Stoke West Brom. Are we going to mention Stoke West
Brom? I've written, oh God, in my notes, and that's it.
Could be a classic. You never know.
Well, Stoke's chairman has basically said to Marquise, if you can't arrange a victory over this shower, you're sacked.
Well, we will discuss all those games on our special Christmas Eve pod. Barry, you're in. Lars, you're in.
I am.
Paolo Bandini joins us as well. Will you bring booze, Barry?
No.
Huh. You said you would off air.
Did I?
I think so.
I thought I said I'd bring booze to our radio show, which is on before the pod.
Okay.
I got the distinct impression they'd be drinking as well, yeah.
Okay. We'll have a Christmas party. So for those of you who hate
your
family...
How sad is it that we're recording a pod on Christmas Eve? We should be with our families.
Well, if people you hate your family, you can listen to the pod instead.
I mean, well, being from Norway, in Norway, Christmas Eve is the day we celebrate, not Christmas Day. So, like, for me, it's even sadder. But, I mean, all the more reason to bring in booze, I guess.
Okay, well, we'll do that. And that'll do for part two. I will begin part three, chatting to Sid in Spain. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's start in Spain and say hello to Sid Lowe. Sid Lowe, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, really good, thank you. El Clasico, Saturday lunchtime. It's a midday kickoff. Is that a weird time for this? It feels it to me.
Yeah, it is, but it's obviously driven by the desire to hit good audiences in the Far East in particular, where they think they have a massive disadvantage with the Premier League. And of course, they're very, very conscious of that. It's also because they've done this slightly bizarre thing, the last round of games, because of the way that the league is structured and also because of the way that the players' union tried to protect the amount of time that players have off over Christmas, there were discussions about, because of when Christmas falls, trying to get a round of games in this weekend. The league would actually, preferably, they'd rather play all the way through Christmas because they think that they lose a huge, again, come back to that Premier League example, they lose a huge amount of audience to the Premier League over Christmas. They said, right, no, we're going to push this as late as we possibly can. But the players union effectively said, well, you've got to give players a chance to get away. So what they've done, instead of having games Saturday, Sunday, Monday, the games all finish on the Saturday. They've been playing this weekend's round of games has been played since Tuesday. So they had Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. The Madrid-Barcelona game at 1 o'clock. The last of the games at 6 o'clock. The idea supposedly being that players can get off on their holidays.
How do you see the game going?
I mean, look, I know it's stating the bleeding obvious to say this. It's difficult to judge because the position in the league obviously suggests that Barcelona have been much, much better than Real Madrid this year. And Real Madrid have certainly been very vulnerable. I mean, they're 11 points clear at the moment. Admittedly, that's having played a game more because of the Club World Cup. But the performances haven't always been that good. Although actually in the last few weeks, Barcelona seem to be kind of getting the ball moving a bit better, creating more chances. They're harder to break down than they used to be, although it is also true that they've relied quite a lot on Ter Stegen. Madrid haven't quite been at their best, but they also possibly haven't been quite as bad as they've looked. And that they're a bit kind of basic at times. It tends to be get the ball wide and cross it in the box. It's given the quality of the players they've got, you'd expect something perhaps a little bit more imaginative, a little bit more nuanced than that. I feel like because they're at home, Real Madrid are favourites. I think that there'll be a temptation from Zidane, particularly as it now looks like Gareth Bale maybe not quite 100% fit, but certainly fit enough to start. I think there might be a temptation to do that, if only to have the option to give them a little bit of pace and to run at Barcelona and perhaps run beyond them if Barcelona try and keep possession. But I think this might be one of those games in which the possession doesn't necessarily tip very clearly in one team's favour or the other.
Sid, will there be added needle was required to this El Clasico because of the political climate in Spain and all the shenanigans that happened a few months ago?
Yeah, almost certainly. I mean, today is election day in Catalonia, and I think we'll have a better sense of kind of how much impact that will have on the game as the results start to come through later on the day. I mean, obviously, you know, the hostage to fortune saying this, but it's certainly plausible that the results are similar to what they were, and so that we kind of get put back into a position largely of stalemate. But then it'll be interesting to see the reactions from the two sides. But yeah, almost certainly that will play a part. I don't know to what extent, because it's actually been quite low key, the build up towards the elections, and the build up to Clasico has largely been football focused rather than politically focused, although there's, you know, two or three kind of broads of football and politics pieces that have appeared today. And as I say, I think off the back of the results, when we know them later on today, there's no doubt that will play a part. I mean, look, this is a rivalry. However much people say sport and politics shouldn't mix, they do mix. And this is a rivalry that for a lot of people is understood through that. And I think that's an ingredient that's always there. So, yeah, I think that will play a part. I suppose the other thing, though, the other kind of big caveat to throw in here is that, generally speaking, the sense of a kind of a political expression of this derby tends to be stronger in the games at the Camp Nou than the games at the Bernabeu. And, of course, this one will be played at the Bernabeu.
We discussed on Monday Antoine Griezmann's blacking up in fancy dress. Just wonder how people reacted in Spain to that.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to producer Jonathan about this quite a lot after you finished recording actually on Monday, but there you go. And it's curious that I wouldn't go so far as to say this hasn't been a story in Spain, but it hasn't been big. There's been no calls for punishment. There's been no call for any kind of ban. I think from a British perspective, I don't know enough about how this would have been received in France. I literally have no idea. But from a British perspective, it can be baffling how little has been said about it and how seemingly unimportant this has been in Spain. I think from a Spanish perspective, it's almost baffling that it even matters. And so it's very curious that it kind of nothing much has happened, which is, I think, what was always quite likely to be the case. It's been commented on. It happened. He apologised, and that's kind of the end of it. As I say, I mean the kind of the cultural sense, the immediate kind of intuitive response to things like this is just very, very different. And so, just as Antoine Griezmann, I'm assuming, because not only did he do this, but of course he put the photo up there, never even contemplated the possibility that this would be seen as offensive, and presumably will be, you know, really quite upset that it was. I think most people in Spain would have a broadly similar reaction. So as I say, that the response to it has been almost nothing.
Sid, could it be argued that we, you know, back in the day before social media and stuff, if you did something wrong and you apologised, that was enough? Now, I would have a problem with the sort of levels of sincerity in Griezmann's apology. It seemed a bit half-hearted. But now, you know, if you mess up and apologise, it's still not enough. You have to be punished. There is this mob mentality that insists you have to be punished. And just on another thing, I think that people in Spain do have form for this, because I seem to remember people at the Spanish Grand Prix blacking up to taunt Lewis Hamilton, and Spanish people, I think, didn't really seem to get what the big problem was.
Well, I mean that's fundamentally the point, as you say, that didn't seem to get the problem, and would in many cases still say there isn't a problem, or that it isn't necessarily. Certainly, I think most would argue, and obviously I think we've seen that in Griezmann's response, that the intent wasn't that, and I think a lot of people in Spain would say, well, it just kind of isn't a thing. And obviously, you know, you're talking about different cultural contexts, you're talking about countries very, very different. Relationships with colour, very different relationships with immigration at very different stages along those kind of processes, and processes which won't necessarily play out in the same way anyway, because of course the identity of immigration in the UK and in Spain has been very different. The extent of it has been very different as well. So the cultural contexts just are very different. And so, as I say, I mean, you know, from a British perspective, it's absolutely baffling that this isn't a big deal. And genuinely, from a Spanish perspective, the response would be, well, it's baffling that it is. And so, as I say, this kind of drifted away and became nothing. And as you say, that again, all of that, the context of that is also the context to previous examples of this in Spain. As you say, the Lewis Hamilton thing, and I think it was a group of four or five with a banner saying Hamilton's family. And so it's kind of quite difficult to reconcile the two things, and it's quite difficult to put the two things together. And so, for example, when things like this happen, I talk to Spanish friends and try and explain why my kind of intuitive immediate reaction is, my goodness, you know, you just can't do this. And then you try and talk through with them the whys, and it's not always that easy to convince and to articulate and to try and, as I say, to try and kind of reconcile the two cultural positions. And so, as I say, so it kind of disappears.
Back to the football. Valencia reportedly agreed a fee for PSG winger Gonzalo Guedes, who's been on loan there. How important is that, or do we know that's happened?
I believe they've denied that it's actually been agreed.
Okay.
It's certainly true that this is a deal they want to make happen. It's true that they believe they have an absolutely fantastic player. It's true as well that their concern, in a way, I mean, to put it in simple terms, right, Valencia want Paris Saint-Germain to win the Champions League. And they want Paris Saint-Germain to win the Champions League with these current players and to be absolutely brilliant, so they don't see the need to bring Guedes back. You know, they want to get this done before such a time as Guedes' fantastic start to the season continues and his price goes up and it becomes almost impossible to get hold of him. So there's absolutely no doubt the intention is there. There's no doubt they'd be willing to pay this kind of fee. But as I say, the report that it's done, Valencia, I believe, have said that that's not actually true.
Well, presumably PSG are under pressure to make something happen with regards to financial fair play. So they, if they have cash, they can send them. Then the, if they can do it now, that could be a thing.
Exactly. Yeah, and the other thing, I mean, I don't know, but, you know, this is, it goes well beyond Geddes, of course. You look at Paris Saint-Germain at the moment, and they're, you know, other big-ish or even very big clubs must be looking at Paris Saint-Germain and thinking, there's three or four very good players we could get here for slightly cheaper than normal because, as you say, they need that cash to try and comply with financial fair play.
Thank you, Sid. Thanks for your time. Chat to you on Christmas Eve. Let's move to Germany. Bayern Munich beat German cup holders Borussia Dortmund 2-1 in the DFB Cup to make it through to the quarterfinals. Jerome Boateng and Thomas Müller with the goals. They've also agreed today a 12 million euro transfer fee with Hoffenheim to sign Sandro Wagner, who's got the number 2 shirt, Lars. Are you upset about this?
Well, the obvious joke is that that's, the number is signifies how many games he's going to play for the rest of the season. but it is aesthetically annoying. But I think it can be quite a canny signing for them, because basically they need a backup to Lewandowski, who doesn't mind just never playing. And Wagner is a youth product, so he goes on the homegrown quota for the Champions League squad as well, and I'm sure he's more than happy to be there. And I was actually in Germany last week, and I saw their game against Cologne, and it was one of those games that I expect Bayern play a lot of, where they have all the possession, but they struggle to break down stubborn German resistance. And there were so many points in that game where I actually thought, you know what, all this James and fancy stuff, you could do it with a big unit in the box right now, to be honest. And Sandro Wagner is a very big unit, so that's probably quite a good signing, actually. A bit low-key, but clever.
Bayer Leverkusen also booked their spot into the quarterfinals with a 1-0 win over Borussia Mönchengladbach, while Schalke and Werder Bremen advanced, along with Mainz, who beat Stuttgart 3-1 on Tuesday. There was a full French programme as well. Some things happened. Cavani scored a ridiculous goal. Has anyone seen this? A sort of like Zola through the legs volley. 24th goal in 25 appearances for PSG. They maintain their 9-point lead at the top of Ligue 1 with a 3-1 win against Caen. Monaco stay second. They won their fourth straight league win, 2-1 against Rennes. And Lyon are level on points on third. They won 2-1 at Toulouse. Barry, what do you make of this AFC Wimbledon being charged with a breach of English Football League regulations following their home match against MK Dons in September, where they refer to the away side as Milton Keynes and MK and did not mention them on their programme cover? The EFL say it sought reassurances from Wimbledon before the League One game to ensure it would be treated in a consistent and appropriate manner.
Well, I think it was consistent and appropriate because it happened the year before previously. And as far as I can remember, they got fined 15 grand and the fans picked up the tab and will do so again this time if they get fined again. So
I think what happened there was a complete disgrace to English football, and it shouldn't be forgotten just because some time has gone on. I think they're entirely right to be angry.
Isn't there, you know, the converse argument, say, look, you know, there are like wars and bad things in the world, and you know, let's just, you're doing well and just crack on now.
No, but
take the moral high ground, be the bigger man. We all know what happened was bad.
I'm sure there's loads of MK fans who are, you know, proper football people who love their club, and there are good people working at the club, and they have a good academy and all this. But, like, completely see it from Wimbledon's perspective. Like, why should we suddenly, like, change our minds about what happened just because some time's gone by? You know, it's important and it should be remembered. We're all about.
But this is how we'll never have world peace, for the same reason.
It really isn't.
Is it not?
No.
Okay.
You're just a wishy-washy twat.
Yeah, you might have a point. A consortium including a Chinese billionaire and the baseball boss, listener to the pod, Billy Bean, have taken over Barnsley. So that's exciting, isn't it? They're 20th in the championship, 4 points above the relegation zone. An exciting chapter is opening for Barnsley Football Club. We're looking forward to the future together. That's the chief executive, Gautier Ganai. Have I pronounced that correctly?
No idea. But they're an interesting... I mean, the Championship's got to be an interesting league from an investment perspective, because it's really tough to get out. But you know what? If you have a club that's slightly well-run and you put a bit of money into it, you can easily like slide into the playoffs, and then anything can happen. And just the riches on offer if you do go up are extraordinary. So if you want to invest in a football club, I reckon the Championship's actually not a bad place to start.
Feedback corner time. Perry has a question, I presume for Lars. Who takes the Sandefjord job now Bahinen has gone to AFC?
I've already answered this. Ivar Mocht-Nomak. He's not the hero we need, but he's the hero we deserve.
Colm says, with the obvious exception of Ryan Babel, do you think any top players listen to this award-winning pod? I'm trying to imagine who, and all I'm seeing is Jordan Henderson kicking back, earphones in, while enjoying an overly milky cup of tea.
I doubt anyone listens to it.
What, anyone at all?
You laugh. Well, I'm always surprised, like we've said this before about the radio show, that we're always surprised to get feedback from, you know, footballers or presenters, or because you tend to forget that anyone actually listens, and then you're surprised when they do. Like Billy Beane, as I said, listens. Who we've got the guys from Mogwai listen. We've got quite a lot of celeb listeners, but I'm not sure if any. Kevin Kilbane's the only footballer I've ever heard of that listens.
Okay, well, if you are a professional footballer,
I mean,
let us know.
Yeah,
I was in a bar the other night, and I went up to order. And the guy said, "Oh, I recognise that accent. You're from Football Weekly, aren't you? You're Barry Glendening, aren't you?"
Oh, no.
And I said, "Yeah." So sorry about that, Barry.
Barry's fame.
Yeah, because I was in the sort of state where it's best to be someone else.
Hey, Barry, thanks for coming today.
You're very welcome.
See you on Christmas Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Lars.
Yep.
Same.
Be great.
Do you want to come, Paul?
No.
We'll be there Christmas Eve. Me, Barry, Lars, Paolo, and not Paul.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.